The city of Merced, which has a population of about 61,000, now has just over 12,000 Hmong. That is to say, one in five residents of Merced is Hmong. Because many Hmong fear and shun the hospital, MCMC's patient rolls reflect a somewhat lower ratio. But on any given day, there are still Hmong patients in almost every unit. Not only do the Hmong fail resoundingly to improve the payer mix, more than 80% are on Medi-Cal. But they have proved even more costly than other indigent patients because they generally require more time and attention. And because there are so many of them that MCMC has had to hire bilingual staff members to mediate between patients and providers. There are no funds in the hospital budget specifically earmarked for interpreters. So the administration has detoured around that technicality by hiring Hmong lab assistants, nurses' aides, and transporters who are called upon to translate in the scarce interstices between analyzing blood, emptying bedpans, and rolling post-operative patients around on gurneys. In 1991, a short-term federal grant enabled MCMC to put skilled interpreters on call around the clock, but the program expired the following year. Except during that brief hiatus, there have been often no Hmong-speaking employees of any kind present in the hospital at night. Obstetricians have had to obtain consent for cesarean sections or episiotomies using embarrassed teenage sons who have learned English in school as translators. 10-year-old girls have had to translate discussions of whether or not a dying family member should be resuscitated. Sometimes not even a child is available. Doctors on the late shift in the emergency room have often had no way of taking a patient's medical history or of asking such questions as, where do you hurt? How long have you been hurting? What does it feel like? Have you had an accident? Have you vomited? Have you had a fever? Have you lost consciousness? Are you pregnant? Have you taken any medications? Are you allergic to any medications? Have you recently eaten? The last question is of great importance if emergency surgery is being contemplated, since anesthetized patients with full stomachs can aspirate the partially digested food into their lungs and may die if they choke or if their bronchial linings are badly burned by stomach acid. I asked one doctor what he did in such cases, and he said, "Practice veterinary medicine." On October 24, 1982, the first time that Phua and Nakao carried Leah to the emergency room, MCMC had not yet hired any interpreters, de jure or de facto, or any shift. At that time, the only hospital employee who sometimes translated for Hmong patients was a janitor, a Laotian immigrant fluent in his own language, Lao, which few Hmong understand, halting in Hmong and even more halting in English. On that day, either the janitor was unavailable or the emergency room staff didn't think of calling him. The resident on duty practiced veterinary medicine. Phua and Nakao had no way of explaining what had happened since Leah's seizures had stopped by the time they reached the hospital. The only obvious symptoms were a cough and a congested chest. The resident ordered an X-ray, which led the radiologist to conclude that Leah had early bronchopneumonia, or tracheobronchitis. As he had no way of knowing that the bronchial congestion was probably caused by aspiration of saliva or vomit during her seizure, a common problem for epileptics, she was routinely dismissed with a prescription for ampicillin, an antibiotic. Her emergency room registration record lists her father's last name as Yang, her mother's maiden name as Phua, and her primary spoken language as M-O-N-G, Hmong. When Leah was discharged, Nakao, who knows the alphabet but does not speak or read English, signed a piece of paper that said, "I hereby acknowledge receipt of the instructions indicated above." To wit, take ampicillin as directed. Vaporizer add cribside. Clinic reached as needed. 383-7007, 10 days. The 10 days meant that Nakao was supposed to call the family practice center in 10 days for a follow-up appointment. Not surprisingly, since he had no idea what he agreed to, He didn't. But when Leah had another seizure on November 11th, he and Fo carried her to the emergency room again, where the same scene was repeated and the same misdiagnosis was made. On March 3, 1983, Fo and Nakao carried Leah to the emergency room a third time. On this occasion, three circumstances were different. Leah was still seizing when they arrived. They were accompanied by a cousin who spoke some English, and one of the doctors on duty was a family practice resident named Dan Murphy. Of all the doctors who have worked at MCMC, Dan Murphy is generally acknowledged to be one of the most interested in and knowledgeable about the Hmong. At that time, he had been living in Merced for only 7 months, so his interest still exceeded his knowledge. When he and his wife Cindy moved to Merced, they had never heard the word Hmong. Several years later, Cindy was teaching English to Hmong adults, and Dan was inviting Hmong leaders to the hospital to tell the residents about their experiences as refugees. Most important, the Murphys counted a Hmong family, the Zhongs, among their closest friends. When one of the Zhong daughters wanted to spend the summer working in Yosemite National Park, Charlie Zhong, her father, initially refused because he was afraid she might get eaten by a lion. Dan personally escorted Charlie to Yosemite to verify the absence of lions and persuaded him the job would do his daughter good. 4 months later, Charlie was killed in an automobile accident. Cindy Murphy arranged the funeral, calling around until she found a funeral parlor that was willing to accommodate 3 days of incense burning, drum beating, and qing playing. She also bought several live chickens, which were sacrificed in the parking lot of the funeral parlor, as well as a calf and a pig, which were sacrificed elsewhere. When Dan first saw the Lees, he instantly registered that they were Hmong, and he thought to himself, "This won't be boring." Many years later, Dan, who is a genial man with an Amish-style beard and an incandescent smile, recalled the encounter. "I have this memory of Leah's parents standing just outside the door to the ER, holding a chubby little round-faced baby. She was having a generalized seizure. Her eyes were rolled back, she was unconscious, her arms and legs were kind of jerking back and forth, and she didn't breathe much. Every once in a while, there would be no movement of the chest wall, and you couldn't hear any breath sounds. That was definitely anxiety-producing. She was the youngest patient I had ever dealt with who was seizing. The parents seemed frightened. Not terribly frightened, though, not as frightened as I would have been if it was my kid. I thought it might be meningitis, so Leah had to have a spinal tap, and the parents were real resistant to that. I don't remember how I convinced them. I remember feeling very anxious because they had a real sick kid, and I felt a big need to explain to these people, through their relative who was not a very good translator, what was going on. But I felt like I had no time, because we had to put an IV in her scalp with Valium to stop the seizures. But then Leah started seizing again, and the IV went into the skin instead of the vein, and I had a hard time getting another one started. Later on, when I figured out what had happened, or not happened, on the earlier visits to the ER, I felt good. It's kind of a thrill to find something someone else has missed, especially when you're a resident and you're looking for excuses to make yourself feel smarter than the other physicians." Among Dan's notes in Leah's history and physical examination record were, "History of present illness. The patient is an 8-month Hmong female whose family brought her to the emergency room after they had noticed her shaking and not breathing very well for a 20-minute period of time. According to the family, the patient has had multiple like episodes in the past, but have never been able to communicate this to the emergency room doctors on previous visits secondary to a language barrier. An English-speaking relative available tonight stated that the patient had had intermittent fever and cough for 2 to 3 days prior to being admitted. Family and social history: unobtainable secondary to language difficulties. Neurological: the child was unresponsive to pain or sound. The head was held to the left with intermittent tonic-clonic, first rigid, then jerking, movements of the upper extremities. Respirations were suppressed during these periods of clonic movement. Grunting respirations persisted until the patient was given 3 milligrams of Valium IV. Dan had no way of knowing that Fo and Nakao had already diagnosed their daughter's problem as the illness where the spirit catches you and you fall down. Fo and Nakao had no way of knowing that Dan had diagnosed it as epilepsy, the most common of all neurological disorders. Each had accurately noted the same symptoms, but Dan would have been surprised to hear that they were caused by soul loss. And Leah's parents would have been surprised to hear that they were caused by an electrochemical storm inside their daughter's head that had been stirred up by the misfiring of aberrant brain cells. Dan had learned in medical school that epilepsy is a sporadic malfunction of the brain, sometimes mild and sometimes severe, sometimes progressive and sometimes self-limiting, which can be traced to oxygen deprivation during gestation, labor, or birth, a head injury, a tumor, an infection, a high fever, a stroke, a metabolic disturbance, a drug allergy, a toxic reaction to poison. Sometimes the source is obvious. The patient had a brain tumor, or swallowed strychnine, or crashed through a windshield. But in about 7 out of 10 cases, the cause is never determined. During an epileptic episode, instead of following their usual orderly protocol, the damaged brain cells in the cerebral cortex transmit neural impulses simultaneously and chaotically. When only a small area of the brain is involved, in a focal seizure, an epileptic may hallucinate, or twitch, or tingle, but retain consciousness. When the electrical disturbances extend to a wide area, in a generalized seizure, consciousness is lost, either for a brief episode called a petit mal or absence seizures or the full-blown attacks known as grand mal. Except through surgery, whose risks consign it to the category of last resort, epilepsy cannot be cured. But it can be completely or partially controlled in most cases by anticonvulsant drugs. The Hmong are not the only people who might have good reason to feel ambivalent about suppressing the symptoms. The Greeks called epilepsy the sacred disease. Dan Murphy's diagnosis added Leah Lee to a distinguished line of epileptics that included Soren Kierkegaard, Vincent van Gogh, Gustave Flaubert, Lewis Carroll, and Fyodor Dostoevsky, all of whom, like many Hmong shamans, experienced powerful senses of grandeur and spiritual passion during their seizures and powerful creative urges in their wake. As Dostoevsky's Prince Mishkin asked, "What if it is a disease? What does it matter that it is an abnormal tension if the result, if the moment of sensation, remembered and analyzed in a state of health, turns out to be harmony and beauty brought to their highest point of perfection and gives a feeling undivined and undreamt of till then of completeness, proportion, reconciliation, and an ecstatic and prayerful fusion in the highest synthesis of life?" Although the inklings Dan had gathered of the transcendental Hmong worldview seemed to him to possess both power and beauty, his own view of medicine in general, and of epilepsy in particular, was like that of his colleagues at MCMC, essentially rationalist. Hippocrates' skeptical commentary on the nature of epilepsy made around 400 BC pretty much sums up Dan's own frame of reference. "It seems to me that the disease is no more divine than any other. It has a natural cause, just as other diseases have. Men think it is divine merely because they don't understand it. But if they called everything divine, which they do not understand, why, there would be no end of divine things." Leah's seizure was a grand mal episode, and Dan had no desire to do anything but stop it. He admitted her to MCMC as an inpatient. Among the tests she had during the 3 days she spent there was a spinal tap, a CT scan, an EEG, a chest X-ray, and extensive blood work. Fo and Nakao signed, authorization for and consent to surgery, or special diagnostic or therapeutic procedures forms, each several hundred words long for the first two of these. It is not known whether anyone attempted to translate them, or if so, how "your physician has requested a brain scan utilizing computerized tomography" was rendered in Hmong. None of the tests revealed any apparent cause for the seizures. The doctors classified Leah's epilepsy as idiopathic, cause unknown. Leah was found to have consolidation in her right lung, which this time was correctly diagnosed as aspiration pneumonia resulting from the seizure. Pho and Akau alternated nights at the hospital, sleeping in a cot next to Leah's bed. Among the nurse's notes for Leah's last night at the hospital were 001, skin cool and dry to the touch, color good and pink. Mom is with babe at this time and is breastfeeding. Mom informed to keep babe covered with a blanket for the babe is a little cool. 0400, babe resting quietly with no acute distress noted. Mom breastfeeds off and on. 0600, sleeping. 0730, awake, color good, mother fed. 1200, held by mother. Leah was discharged on March 11, 1983. Her parents were instructed via an English-speaking relative to give her 250 milligrams of ampicillin twice a day to clear up her aspiration pneumonia and 20 milligrams of Dilantin elixir as an anticonvulsant twice a day to suppress any further grand mal seizures. Chapter 4. Do doctors eat brains? In 1982, Mao Tao, a Hmong woman from Laos who had resettled in St. Paul, Minnesota, visited Ban Vi Nai, the refugee camp in Thailand where she had lived for a year after her escape from Laos in 1975. She was the first Hmong American to ever return there, and when an officer of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which administered the camp, asked her to speak about life in the United States, 15,000 Hmong, more than a third of the population of Ban Vi Nai, assembled in a soccer field and questioned her for nearly 4 hours. Some of the questions they asked her were, "Is it forbidden to use a zineng to heal an illness in the United States? Why do American doctors take so much blood from their patients? After you die, why do American doctors try to open up your head and take out your brains? Why do American doctors eat the livers, kidneys, and brains of Hmong patients? When Hmong people die in the United States, is it true that they are cut into pieces and put in tin cans and sold as food?" The general drift of these questions suggests that the accounts of the American healthcare system that had filtered back to Asia were not exactly enthusiastic. The limited contact the Hmong had already had with Western medicine in the camp hospitals and clinics had done little to instill confidence, especially when compared to the experiences with shamanistic healing to which they were accustomed. A zineng might spend as much as 8 hours in a sick person's home. Doctors forced their patients, no matter how weak they were, to come to the hospital and then might spend only 20 minutes at their bedsides. Zinengs were polite and never needed to ask questions. Doctors asked many rude and intimate questions about patients' lives, right down to their sexual and excretory habits. Zinengs could render an immediate diagnosis. Doctors often demanded samples of blood or even urine or feces, which they liked to keep in little bottles, took x-rays and waited for days for the results to come back from the laboratory, and then, after all that, sometimes they were unable to identify the cause of the problem. Zinengs never undressed their patients. Doctors asked patients to take off all their clothes and sometimes dared to put their fingers inside women's vaginas. Zinengs knew that to treat the body without treating the soul was an act of patent folly. Doctors never even mentioned the soul. Zinengs could preserve unblemished reputations even if their patients didn't get well, since the blame was laid on the intransigence of the spirits rather than the competence of the negotiators, whose stock might even rise if they had had to do battle with particularly dangerous opponents. When doctors failed to heal, it was their own fault. To add injury to insult, some of the doctors' procedures actually seemed more likely to threaten their patients' health than to restore it. Most Hmong believe that the body contains a finite amount of blood that is unable to replenish, so repeated blood sampling, especially from small children, may be fatal. When people are unconscious, their souls are at large, so anesthesia may lead to illness or death. If the body is cut or disfigured, or if it loses any of its parts, it will remain in a condition of perpetual imbalance, and the damaged person not only will become frequently ill, but may be physically incomplete during the next incarnation, so surgery is taboo. If people lose their vital organs after death, their souls cannot be reborn into new bodies and may take revenge on the living relatives, so autopsies and embalming are also taboo. Some of the questions on the Ban Vi Nai soccer field were obviously inspired by reports of the widespread practice of autopsy and embalming in the United States. To make the leap from hearing that doctors removed organs to believing that they ate them was probably no crazier than to assume, as did American doctors, that the Hmong ate human placentas. But it was certainly scarier. The only form of medical treatment that was gratefully accepted by at least some of the Hmong in the Thai camps was antibiotic therapy, either oral or by injection. Most Hmong have little fear of needles, perhaps because some of their own healers, Nazi Nings, who never touched their patients, attempted to release fevers and toxicity through acupuncture and other forms of dermal treatment, such as massage, pinching, scraping the skin with coins, spoons, silver jewelry, or pieces of bamboo, applying a heated cup to the skin, or burning the skin with a sheaf of grass or a wad of cotton wool. An antibiotic shot that could heal an infection almost overnight was welcomed. A shot to immunize someone against a disease he did not yet have was something else again. In his book, Les Naufrages de la Liberté, the French physician Jean-Pierre Willem, who worked as a volunteer in the hospital at Nam Yao camp, related how during a typhoid epidemic, the Hmong refugees refused to be vaccinated until they were told that only those who got shots would receive their usual allotments of rice, whereupon 14,000 people showed up at the hospital, including at least 1,000 who came twice in order to get seconds. When Fo Yang and Nakao Li brought their 3 sick children to the hospital at Mae Jerim, they were engaging in behavior that many other camp inhabitants would have considered positively aberrant. Hospitals were regarded not as places of healing, but as charnel houses. They were populated by the spirits of people who had died there, a lonesome and rapacious crew who were eager to swell their own ranks. Catherine Paik, a public health nurse who spent 6 months working at Panat Nikhom, a camp where refugees from Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia came for their final processing before they were sent to a country of permanent asylum, concluded from a study of the hospital log that in comparison to refugees of other ethnic groups, the Hmong have the lowest per capita rate of visits. Paik also discovered, not coincidentally, that the Hmong had an extremely high utilization rate of indigenous healing arts, shamanism, dermal treatments, herbalism. She published an article in the Journal of Ethnobiology identifying 20 medicinal plants she had collected under the tutelage of Hmong herbalists, which in various forms, chopped, crushed, dried, shredded, powdered, decocted, infused with hot water, infused with cold water, mixed with ashes, mixed with sulfur, mixed with egg, mixed with chicken, were indicated for burns, fever, weakness, poor vision, broken bones, stomach aches, painful urination, prolapsed uterus, insufficient breast milk, arthritis, anemia, tuberculosis, rabies, scabies, gonorrhea, dysentery, constipation, impotence, and attacks by Adanzu, a spirit who lives in the jungle and causes epidemics when he is disturbed. In this last case, the plant Jetropha curcus is crushed and its oil left in a cup to be consumed not by the patient, but by the da. Wendy Walker Moffat, an educational consultant who spent 3 years teaching and working on nutritional and agricultural projects in Panat Nikom and Ban Vinai, suggests that one reason the Hmong avoided the camp hospitals is that so many of the medical staff members were excessively zealous volunteers from Christian charitable organizations. They were there to provide medical aid, but they were also there, though not overtly, to convert people, Walker Moffat told me. And part of becoming converted was believing in Western medicine. I'll never forget one conversation I overheard when I was working in the hospital area at Ban Vinai. A group of doctors and nurses were talking to a Hmong man whom they had converted and ordained as a Protestant minister. They had decided that in order to get the Hmong to come into the hospital, they were going to allow a traditional healer, a shaman, to practice there. I knew they all thought shamanism was witch doctoring. So I heard them tell this Hmong minister that if they let a shaman work in the medical center, he could only give out herbs and not perform any actual work with the spirits. At this point, they asked the poor Hmong minister, "Now, you never go to a shaman, do you?" He was a Christian convert. He knew you cannot tell a lie, so he said, "Well, yes, I do." But then their reaction was so shocked that he said, "No, no, no, I've never been. I've just heard that other people go." What they didn't realize was that, to my knowledge, at least, no Hmong is ever fully converted. In 1985, the International Rescue Committee assigned Dwight Conkergood, a young ethnographer with a special interest in shamanism and performance art, to design an environmental health program for Ban Vinai. He later wrote, "I heard horror story after horror story from the refugees about people who went to the hospital for treatment, but before being admitted, had their spirit strings cut from their wrists by a nurse because the strings were unsanitary and carried germs. The doctors confidently cut off neck rings that held the life souls of babies intact. Instead of working in cooperation with the shamans, they did everything to disconform them and undermine their authority. Is it any wonder that the Hmong community regarded the camp hospital as the last choice of available healthcare options? In the local hierarchy of values, consulting a shaman or herbalist or purchasing medicine available in the Thai market just outside the entrance to the camp was much preferred and more prestigious than going to the camp hospital. The refugees told me that only the very poorest people who had no relatives or resources whatsoever would subject themselves to the camp hospital treatment. To say that the camp hospital was underutilized would be an understatement. Unlike the other camp volunteers who commuted from an expatriate enclave an hour away, Conkergood insisted on living in Ban Vinai, sharing the corner of a thatched hut with 7 chickens and a pig. His first day in camp, Conkergood noticed a Hmong woman sitting on a bench singing folk songs. Her face was decorated with little blue moons and golden suns, which he recognized as stickers the camp clinic placed on medication bottles to inform illiterate patients whether the pills should be taken morning or night. The fact that Conkergood considered this a delightful example of creative costume design rather than an act of medical noncompliance suggests some of the reasons why the program he designed turned out to be the most, indeed possibly the only, completely successful attempt at healthcare delivery Ban Vinai had ever seen. Conkergood's first challenge came after an outbreak of rabies among the camp dogs prompted a mass dog vaccination campaign by the medical staff, during which the Ban Vinai inhabitants failed to bring in a single dog to be inoculated. Conkergood was asked to come up with a new campaign. He decided on a rabies parade, a procession led by 3 important characters from Hmong folktales, a tiger, a chicken, and a da dressed in homemade costumes. The cast, like its audience, was 100% Hmong. As the parade snaked through the camp, the tiger danced and played the qing, The Das sang and banged a drum, and the chicken, chosen for its crucial role because of its traditional powers of augury, explained the etiology of rabies through a bullhorn. The next morning, the vaccination stations were so besieged by dogs, dogs carried in their owners' arms, dogs dragged on rope leashes, dogs rolled in on two-wheeled push carts, that the health workers could hardly inoculate them fast enough. Conquer Good's next production, a sanitation campaign in which a parade of children led by Mother Clean, a huge, insanely grinning figure on a bamboo frame, and the garbage troll, dressed in ragged clothes plastered with trash, sang songs about latrine use and refuse disposal, was equally well-received. During Conquer Good's 5 months in Banvinai, he himself was successfully treated with Hmong herbs for diarrhea and a gashed toe. When he contracted dengue fever, for which he also sought conventional medical treatment, a Tsineng informed him that his homesick soul had wandered back to Chicago, and two chickens were sacrificed to expedite its return. Conquer Good considered his relationship with the Hmong to be a form of barter, a productive and mutually invigorating dialogue, with neither side dominating or winning out. In his opinion, the physicians and nurses at Banvinai failed to win the cooperation of the camp inhabitants because they considered the relationship one-sided, with the Westerners holding all the knowledge. As long as they persisted in this view, Conquer Good believed that what the medical establishment was offering would continue to be rejected, since the Hmong would view it not as a gift, but as a form of coercion. Chapter 5. Take as Directed. Between the ages of 8 months and 4.5 years, Lia Li was admitted to the MCMC 17 times and made more than 100 outpatient visits to the emergency room and to the pediatric clinic at the family practice center. Hmong, female, read the admission notes. Then, Hmong, female, well known to this facility. Then, Hmong, female, very well known to this facility. Sometimes instead of Hmong, the notes say Hamond or Hmong. Or, in one note transcribed from a tape dictated by a resident, Mongoloid. An attempt by a tired typist to make sense of the strange syllable not to be found in any medical dictionary. Under How Arrived, the notes always say, Via Mo's Arms. Under Initial Diagnostic Impression, always Seizure Disorder of Unknown Etiology. And sometimes Fever and Pneumonia in Infections of the Middle Ear. Under Insurance Coverage, always Medi-Cal. Under Amount Paid by Patient, always Zero. Almost all of the admission notes contain the phrase, Language Barrier. On one assessment form, a nurse's aide with a Hispanic surname has written, Unable to obtain patient speak no English. On another form, in the space marked Communication Problems, another nurse has summed up the situation in a single word, Hmong. Pho and Nakao always knew exactly when a seizure was coming because Lia knew. The aura, a sense of premonition common to epileptics and sufferers of migraine and angina, can take many forms, from mildly peculiar sensations, sudden tastes or smells, tingling, flushing, déjà vu, jamais vu, the feeling that an experience is utterly unfamiliar, to mortal terror. Physicians in the 18th century called the frightening auras angor enemy, soul anguish, a concept any Hmong might recognize. Before Lia fell, she would run to her parents to be hugged. She also demanded plenty of hugs from them when she was feeling fine, but they recognized these occasions as different because she had a strange, scared expression, and they would gently pick her up and lay her on the mattress they kept for this purpose on the floor of their living room, which was otherwise unfurnished. Sometimes there was twitching on one side of her body, usually the right. Sometimes she had staring spells. Sometimes she seemed to hallucinate, rapidly scanning the air and reaching for invisible objects. As Lia got older, The abnormal electrical activity spread to larger and larger areas of her brain and triggered more frequent grand mal episodes. As she lay face up, her back would arch so violently that only her heels and the back of her head would touch the mattress. And then, after a minute or so of rigid muscle contractions, her arms and legs would start to thrash. During the first phase, her respiratory muscles contracted along with the rest of her body, and she would often stop breathing. Her lips and nail beds turned blue. Sometimes she gave high-pitched gasps, foamed at the mouth, and vomited, urinated, or defecated. Sometimes she had several seizures in a row. Between them, she would tense, point her toes, and cry a strange, deep cry. In the most serious episodes, Leah would continue seizing and seizing without regaining consciousness. This condition, called status epilepticus, when it lasts for 20 minutes or longer, is what the doctors in the MCMC emergency room feared most. Leah usually remained in status until massive doses of anticonvulsant medication could be administered intravenously. Inserting a needle into the vein of a baby who is having convulsions is like shooting, or trying to shoot, a very small moving target. While the hapless young resident who happened to be on call maneuvered the needle, he or she, always acutely aware that as each second ticked away during the phases of respiratory arrest, Leah's brain was being deprived of oxygen. When I asked one nurse whether this caused brain damage, he said, "If you want to know what a 5-minute seizure is like, go stick your head in a bucket of water for 5 minutes and take some deep breaths." Over the course of several years, Leah was treated at least once, and sometimes many times, by each of MCMC's residents. Frightening as it was to be on duty when Leah was brought in at 3 a.m., there was probably no other group of family practice residents in the United States who by the end of their 3-year program were so familiar with the management of pediatric grand mal seizures. The residents were merely the first line of defense. Every time Leah came to the emergency room, either Neil Ernst or Peggy Philp, the two supervising pediatricians who served on the faculty of the Family Practice Residency Program, was paged, and no matter how late it was, drove to the hospital, a trip that could be accomplished at just under the speed limit in 7 minutes. Peggy Philp was the physician Dan Murphy consulted during Leah's first admission to MCMC. The note she wrote 6 days after Leah's discharge read, in part, "This is a very interesting young infant who presents with a history of right focal seizures, one leading to a grand mal seizure. I feel that probably the grand mal seizure caused an aspiration pneumonia and hence apnea, causing her extreme distress when she showed up in the emergency room on the day of admission. The child has apparently done well on her Dilantin, although she has continued to have some right focal seizures. My feeling is that this child probably has some form of benign focal seizures of infancy. These are not especially common, but can often be quite benign in nature. Since there is apparently some chance that these will generalize, it is probably worthwhile to keep the child on Dilantin therapy to suppress a grand mal seizure. I would check the Dilantin level to make sure that it remains therapeutic. I think that the prognosis for this child's intellectual development remains good." Looking back on this optimistic document several years later, Peggy explained, "Most epileptics are controlled relatively easily by seizure medications. Leah's disorder turned out to be much more severe than what you usually see in classic epilepsy." Leah's chart eventually grew to 5 volumes, longer than the chart of any other child who had ever been admitted to MCMC, and weighed 13 pounds, 11 ounces, considerably more than Leah weighed when she was born there. Neil and Peggy once went through a photocopy of it with me. Over a period of several evenings, the two doctors worked with the same briskness and efficiency they would have brought to a patient's diagnostic examination, arranging the thousands of pages in neat stacks, rapidly discarding any they deemed irrelevant, never skipping over, in fact, often specifically pointing out details that failed to put them in the best possible light, and stopping every once in a while to laugh ruefully at the chart's many errors. The errors were invariably made by transcribers, nurses, or other physicians. Their own contributions were flawless and usually even legible. She was seen to have lice coming out of her nose? Lice. That can't be right. Ice? Mice? Rice! Shoot, that's what it is. Rice! Sometimes Neil would stop and stare at a page, often one that seemed anesthetically dull to me, and shake his head and sigh and say, "Oh God, Leah." When we looked through the records of Leah's first visits to the emergency room, he started to flip the pages back and forth with angry little slapping motions. He had forgotten that she had had epileptic seizures for 5 months before they were diagnosed and medicated, and was wondering in retrospect whether the course of her life might have been different if his hospital had offered her optimal medical care from the beginning. Neil Ernst and Peggy Philp are married to each other. They alternate call nights, and each prayed that when a Leah Lee call came, it would be the other one's turn to roll out of bed. Neil and Peggy are both the children of physicians, both high school valedictorians, both Phi Beta Kappa graduates of Berkeley. They met when they were 19 and 18, two tall, good-looking, athletic, premed students who recognized in each other the combination of idealism and workaholism that had simultaneously contributed to their successes and set them apart from most of their peers. By the time their lives intersected with Leah's, they had shared a practice and a half, as well as an office, a beeper, and a byline on the articles they had published in medical journals. Neil's curriculum vitae, which was flush with academic and professional honors, was the only one I have ever seen that noted marital status and children first. Their schedules were arranged in such a way that one of them was always home in the afternoon when their two sons got out of school. Every morning, the alarm buzzed at 5:45. If it was Monday, Wednesday, or Friday, Neil got up and ran 8 miles. If it was Tuesday, Thursday, or Sunday, Peggy got up and ran 8 miles. They alternated Saturdays. Their runs were the only time either of them was entirely alone for more than a few minutes, and they never skipped or traded a morning, even if they had been up most of the night on call at MCMC. "I am a fairly driven and compulsive kind of person," Neil told me one night in the living room of their extremely neat ranch-style house, the care of which was evenly split between them. Peggy was on call at the hospital. "Peggy is very similar to me. We get along real well. Real, real well. Medically, we complement each other. My strengths are infections, asthma, and allergies. Peggy is strong in hematology, and she's better than I am in child development. When you're confronted with a difficult decision, it's nice to talk to someone whose judgment you respect. Am I thinking okay? Would you offer anything else? Can I do anything else? If I feel like a dumb shit, I can be a dumb shit with her. We don't have to impress each other. If she was not in my life, it would, well, take a while for me to be able to function." I once asked Teresa Callahan and Benny Douglas, a pair of married family physicians who trained as residents under Neil Ernst and Peggy Philp, and who, like their mentors, now share a practice, what they thought of them. Teresa said, "It's hard to perceive them separately." Benny said, "I mean, like, Neil apostrophe N apostrophe Peggy is the way we think of them. Neil and Peggy know everything and they never make mistakes. They are perfect. If we ever had problems, all we had to do was call Neil and Peggy and they would figure it out," Teresa said. "Neil and Peggy are controlled, Neil especially, almost to a fault. I have even heard him say, about getting angry or crying, that he just doesn't feel comfortable doing things like that. But that doesn't mean he isn't compassionate. He prides himself on establishing a good rapport with his clinic patients, including some very difficult ones, some Spanish-speaking, and most patients accept what he and Peggy say as gospel and do whatever they say. Few other people I know would have gone to the lengths they did to provide good medical care to Leah. They were always thinking about her, Whenever they had to go away, they'd tell all the residents. Now, if this little fat Hmong girl comes in seizing... Leah was indeed fat. Her physical growth chart shows that although her height usually hovered around the 5th percentile for her age, not unusual for a Hmong child, her weight climbed as high as the 75th percentile. Her thick subcutaneous padding compounded the challenges that awaited the doctors in the emergency room. Neil Ernst wrote in a pediatric clinic note that in addition to her seizure disorder, Leah's other problem, which is of considerable concern, is the fact that she is quite overweight, which makes intravenous access during the time of seizures quite difficult. Considerable effort has gone into weight control in this child. The father apparently likes Leah the way she is and is somewhat resistant to this problem. In Laos, where food was often scarce, a plump Hmong child was perceived as healthy and especially well cared for. A vein hidden under fat is hard to palpate. Like a drug user who loses veins after repeated needle sticks, Leah eventually lost the antecubital veins in both forearms and the saphenous vein above her left ankle after doctors frantically searching for a needle placement cut them open and tied them off. During most of her hospitalizations, the arm or leg with the IV line was bandaged to a board, and sometimes she was secured to her crib as well. Leah's IVs were precious, explained Neil. The less she moved, the longer the IV would last. One nurse's note reads, 2400. IV infusing R antecubital space with signs of infiltration at 30 cc's per hour via pump. Father here. Soft restraint to L arm. 0015. Father had untied restraint and placed child on cot on floor. Returned child to bed. Soft restraint to R arm. Tried to explain to father reason, but difficult due to communication barrier. Nakao did not understand why the nurses had tied up his daughter. His confidence in their ability to care for Leah was further strained the morning after this note was written, when he left the hospital at 4 a.m. to catch 2 or 3 hours of sleep at home and then returned at 7:30 to find that Leah had a bump on her forehead the size of a goose egg, the result of having fallen out of her crib during his brief absence. Not only had Leah gotten hurt while under the supervision of people who claimed to know more than the leaves about how to keep her healthy, but those people had then responded to the accident in a manner that, from the Lee's point of view, was inexplicably sadistic. Fo and Nakao believed the best way to keep Leah safe and content, especially when she was ill or in pain, was to have her sleep next to them, as she always did, at home, so they could immediately comfort her whenever she cried. The nurses, however, decided to guard against future falls by rigging a net over Leah's crib and caging her inside, out of reach of her parents' arms. A hospital is a scary place for any parent. Vonda Kraus, a physician at Valley Children's Hospital in Fresno who is on the faculty of the Merced Family Practice Residency Program, told me. You see, people wake up your sleeping child to take their blood pressure, take their temperature, check their pulse, and count respirations. You see them put a bag on your kid to measure the output of urine and stool. When your child is in the hospital, suddenly somebody else is feeding them, somebody else is changing their pants, somebody else is deciding how and when they will be bathed. It takes all the autonomy of being a parent away, even for folks who have had a lot of medical experience. It would be that much harder if you were from another culture and didn't understand the purpose of all these things. Aside from the time Leah fell on her head, one or another of her parents was almost always present around the clock during her hospital stays. Some typical nurse's notes. Does not like to be separated from Mo. Relaxes when held by Mo. Is quiet as long as Mom holds her, otherwise screams most of the time. Child is happy and babbling, plays with toys, Mom here, babe content. Being carried papoo style by Fa. Mother here and breastfeeds eagerly. Cruises sides of cribs. Makes baby sounds. Awake. Walking around to the hallway with the father, then return to the room. Father trying to put her back to sleep. Baby was in wagon sitting up and had generalized seizure lasting 1 minute. Father grabbed her right away, no injuries. Mother holding, no seizures this shift. Up in Mom's arms, waves, bye-bye. The MCMC nursing staff came to know Leah well, better, in fact, than most of them would have wished. After she was old enough to walk, whenever she was well enough to get out of bed, she ran up and down the corridor in the pediatric unit, banging on doors, barging into rooms of other sick children, yanking open the doors in the nursing station, snatching pencils and hospital forms and prescription pads and throwing them on the floor. "You'd hear that Leah was in the ER," recalled Sharon Yates, a nurse's aide. "Leah, Leah. Oh, please," you'd say. "Don't let her up." But up she'd come. Evelyn Marcel, a nurse, said, "Leah was a pretty girl, soft and cute and fast. Her mother wouldn't wean her, and she was real dependent on the breast. She was a little Houdini. She could get out of anything, and she'd hurt herself even if she had her wrist bound up, so you could never let her alone." "Her attention span was real short," said Gloria Rodriguez, a nurse. "We taught her to say bye, play patty cake, smile, and clap hands. But she always wanted to be held. She always put her hands up to be carried because that's what her parents did. With other Hmong families, the sons are the ones who are loved. Hmong fathers say, 'Girl, okay, if die, want many boy.' But this family, they wanted so much for her to live. They just adored her." Many of the doctors remember Leah with affection because, unlike most of their pediatric patients, she was always physically demonstrative. "She liked skin," recalled Chris Hartwig, one of the patients who took care of Leah. "Even when I was trying to start an intravenous line, she'd be going pick, pick, pick at my arm. When you asked for a hug, you could always get one from Leah." Peggy Phillips said, "A lot of little kids, after being through all of that, would just cry and hide in a corner or something. But Leah was very bold, and she wasn't afraid of you. So you kind of liked her because she was a character, even though you hated her because she was so frustrating and she caused you so much grief." Leah hated swallowing her medications. Some nurses' notes: "Meds given, but did not like. Tries to spit out phenobarb when given. Lips pursed tightly to prevent this, med given. Fought taking medicine, even crushed phenobarb tablets in applesauce. Spits well. Patient very good at spitting out meds, given slowly with arms held and mouth puckered open. Spit out popsicle with medicine crushed in, had to repeat dose with strawberry ice cream, this time taken well." The Lees had an even harder time persuading Leah to take her medication than the nurses did, since they were reluctant to restrain her arms or force anything down her throat. And even when Leah was cooperative, Fu and Nakao were often uncertain about exactly what they were supposed to give her. Over time, her drug regimen became so complicated and underwent so many revisions that keeping track of it would have been a monumental task even for a family that could read English. For the Lees, it proved to be utterly confounding. The anticonvulsant medication originally prescribed by Peggy Philp was Dilantin, which is commonly used to control grand mal seizures. 3 weeks after her first MCMC admission, after Leah had had a seizure in the hospital waiting room that appeared to be triggered by a fever, Peggy changed the prescription to phenobarbital, which controls febrile seizures better than Dilantin. Leah seized several times during the next 2 weeks, so since neither drug appeared to work adequately alone, Peggy then prescribed them both simultaneously. Consulting neurologists later prescribed two other anticonvulsants: Tegretol, which was originally to be used along with both Dilantin and phenobarbital, and then just with phenobarbital, and Depakine, which was to be used in place of all previous anticonvulsants. Because lung and ear infections frequently accompanied Leah's seizures, antibiotics, antihistamines, and bronchodilating drugs were also prescribed from time to time. By the time she was 4 and a half, Leah's parents had been told to give her, at various times, Tylenol, ampicillin, amoxicillin, Dilantin, phenobarbital, erythromycin, C-chlor, Tegretol, Benadryl, Pediazole, Vidalin, multivitamins with iron, Olupant, Depakane, and Valium. Because these medications were prescribed in varying combinations, varying amounts, and varying numbers of times a day, the prescriptions changed 23 times in less than 4 years. Some of the drugs, such as vitamins and anticonvulsants, were supposed to be given every day no matter how Leah was feeling, and when they ran out, her parents were supposed to renew the prescriptions. Some, such as antibiotics, were supposed to be given for a specific period of time, and although they were prescribed only when Leah displayed certain symptoms, the prescriptions were to be finished, but not renewed, even if those symptoms disappeared. Antifebrile medications, prescribed in the hope of warding off fever-triggered seizures before they happened, were supposed to be administered only if Leah had a temperature, a plan that might have worked better if her parents had been able to read a thermometer. Several of the medications were available in different forms, and some were sometimes prescribed as elixirs, all of which were pink or red and came in round bottles, and sometimes as tablets, almost all of which were white and came in round bottles. Fu and Nakao, of course, had no idea what the label said. Even if a relative or the hospital janitor was found on hand to translate when a bottle was handed to the Lees, they had no way of writing down the instructions, since they are illiterate in Hmong as well as English. And because the prescriptions change so frequently, they often forgot what the doctors told them. Measuring the correct doses posed additional problems. Liquids were difficult because the Lees could not read the markings on medicine droppers or measuring spoons. Pills were often no easier. At one point, when Leah was 2, she was supposed to be taking 4 different medications in tablet form twice a day, but because each of the pills contained an adult dose, her parents were supposed to cut each of the tablets into fractions. And because Leah disliked swallowing the pills, each of those fractions had to be pulverized into a spoon and mixed with food. If she then ate less than a full helping of the adulterated food, there was no way to know how much medicine she had actually consumed. At first, it did not occur to Leah's doctors that the Lees would fail to administer her medications correctly. The first few prescriptions simply read, "Take as directed." In May of 1983, 2 months after Leah's first hospital admission, when a blood test showed a subtherapeutic level of phenobarbital in Leah's system, Peggy Philp assumed that the prescribed amount was being given and raised the dosage. The next month, when the levels tested low again, she began to suspect that when Leah's mother said she was giving the medicines as prescribed, she was either confused or lying. This was a dismaying realization. The only way to determine the optimal type and amount of anticonvulsant medications for Leah was to observe the level of her seizure activity and repeatedly test the medication level in her blood. But the test results were inconclusive unless the doctors knew exactly what was going into her system. "Leah continued to have seizures," said Peggy. "But was she having those seizures because she didn't have enough phenobarbital in her blood? Or was she having seizures in spite of having enough phenobarbital in her blood? And if the parents weren't giving what we told them to give, was it because they hadn't understood? Or because they didn't want to? We just couldn't tell." The absence of good interpreters was only part of the communication problem. Neil felt that Nakao put up a stone wall and was sometimes deliberately deceitful. Peggy felt that Fu was either very stupid or a loony bird, because her answers, even on those occasions when they were accurately translated, often didn't make sense. Neither doctor could tell how much of their inability to get through was caused by what they perceived as defects of intelligence or moral character, and how much was caused by cultural barriers. Neil recalled later, "It felt as if there was this layer of saran wrap or something between us, and they were on one side of it, and we were on the other side of it. And we were reaching and reaching, and we could kind of get into their area, but we couldn't touch them. So we couldn't really accomplish what we were trying to do, which was take care of Leah." On June 28, 1983, MCMC asked the Merced County Health Department to send a nurse to the Lee home, accompanied by a Hmong interpreter, to try to improve the family's compliance with Leah's medication regimen.